This episode is brought to you by VideoBlocks.com. Go to VideoBlocks.com/NotAlone to learn how to claim your exclusive offer for being a listener of the Not Alone podcast. We are also brought to you by the amazing support of our patrons over at patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Head over there to find out how you can get access to the show a few days early. You can get access to bonus episodes, all sorts of great rewards for supporting your favorite show. Again, that's patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Thank you so much to everyone who pledges to us each month and really helps us keep the lights on.
Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moizoso.
And today we have another spooky story from England.
Oh boy. Yes. I can't wait, of course.
I don't know what my problem is, but I've been able to find are spooky stories from that part of the world.
Dude, England is so much older than the U.S.
It is.
Like, it is old as snot.
There's a lot more opportunity for spook.
The house that we're talking about is so stupidly old that it's just, I can't fathom, like, actually its age. Like, I can't, what? Like, it's I don't not... understand how it's still, like, well, up.
My wife does say
it's
she
like
went to
almost 200 years old.
Yeah, right? So Katie has an uncle in Scotland.
We should go there for his birthday.
And with... Happy birthday, house.
You're 200.
Katie has an uncle in Scotland, and they went on, like, some tours and some stuff while they were around.
Uh-huh.
And the tour guide was like, oh, I love Americans, because all I have to say is that this door is 500 years old, and you all lose your minds. And everyone was like, it's 500 years old? And he's like, it's 500 years old.
It's that awesome. Is us in a nutshell.
Well, it was like when we did the Black Shuck episode, like that church was like 500 years, or not the Black Shuck, the Hound of Mons.
Yeah.
Where we talked about Black Shuck. That church is like 500 years old, and it's still just...
It's dead. Unreal. I just don't get it. Yeah.
It's seriously crazy.
I'm like, this house is made out of wood, right? How is it still here? How do
Isn't
they
this
keep
wood?
This?
I feel like this is wood.
What stuff happens to wood, right? It deteriorates, but I am not a carpenter, so I have no idea about the longevity of framework.
I'm glad that you admit that. Anyway, back on topic. We are coming at you again. This with another British, a little more in the realm of urban legend.
So what are we talking about? Like a vampire again, or what? What are we into?
Well, we're looking at, this time, instead of a vampire, it's more of like it's a house. That's what it is.
Is it the Monster House?
It is the Monster House. Basically,
such a
so
good movie.
What we wanted, right? It's Christmas coming up. Happy holidays. Happy Merry Christmas, everybody. We were hoping to find some sort of event that would, you know, put some holiday spirit in it, but we couldn't do that.
Holiday spirit. Clever.
Okay. What?
Spirits.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't even get that. Now, the closest we came to is brushing up on Charles Dickens, which we'll talk about him here in a minute.
Yeah.
But we couldn't find anything full-blown Christmas. So instead we're doing, like I said, another British urban legend. This one is a little bit more speculative than the murder of Charles Walton.
Right, we don't actually have a body to look
right.
at.
Well, right. Theoretically, they did at one point, but this week we're going to be speaking about number 50 Berkeley Square in London. Now, the house itself is located in what we understand to be, I don't know for sure, but we understand it to be a very fashionable part of London called Berkeley Square, which this is in an area called the Mayfair District. Okay, the Mayfair District, according to Google, is one of the most expensive places to live in the world.
Wow.
Yep. And
okay.
therefore,
okay.
it's a little bit weird. It's a little bit strange. You know, usually these affluent places, they don't have spooks. I don't know why, but they just don't. I mean, castles do.
Because they're too high class to have spooks.
Yes, exactly.
They get an exterminator for this.
They ghost bust them. But this house is there nonetheless. Now, it was built sometime in the late 18th century, and it was the home primarily, or it is notable for being the home of the British Prime Minister George Canning, who served the shortest amount of time as a prime minister. He only served 119 days in office, and then he died on the job, which is just so sad. That's just terrible. You work all your life to be prime minister, and then you just die 3 months in.
Hey, you made it.
You made it. You did it.
You died a prime minister. That's impressive, though.
He died in 1827. Now, from there, the house kind of went, it was occupied and then unoccupied, and people were in and out and this and that, until finally, at some point, a tenant named Miss Elizabeth Curzon, she moved into the house and then died there in 1859. So it was pretty well inhabited around that time. But after her death, the house fell into disrepair, and many people believed it to be completely and totally unoccupied due to the absence of movement or life or anything. However, everyone was scratching their heads at this. They were saying Mayfair is such a nice place to live. Why is it empty? I just don't understand. And then the next thing that people noticed...
Tell me, Sam, what did they notice?
Spooks.
Spooks! They noticed spooks!
Basically, there would be there'd be reports of people walking around Berkeley Square at night, and they would see a light drifting from room to room, and they would hear wailing coming out of the house.
Well, I mean, that doesn't seem so weird. What if you were carrying a light and you stubbed your toe?
But that no one lives in the house.
It could be a hermit.
I guess. It's possible. But this is really where it began to gain this idea, this prestige as a haunted house, or the lack of prestige.
Yes.
And periodicals of the time will confirm this. There's multiple accounts of spookernatural activity within the home around this time.
Is that your word?
Yes, spookernatural. I did not make it up, but I am coining it. I don't know if I'm allowed to. I'm copywriting. It's mine. Trademarking.
That's what it is.
Spookernatural TM. Periodicals of the time confirm that the public opinion about the house began to change around this time.
I'm sure it started to deteriorate a little bit.
It did as well. That was the thing, right? It's supposedly empty. It starts going into just this ramshackle mess.
Yeah,
just
number
over time.
49 and 51, we're starting to say bad things about it.
Yeah, and their property values
went
down.
Oh, that number 50. He's driving us all down.
It's terrible. Particularly, you can find accounts in the Mayfair Weekly magazine. Here's the thing about that, though.
Ooh.
Mayfair, uh-huh. I learned this the hard way. It's a men's magazine.
Ooh.
Not this Mayfair magazine. It's an adult magazine. So if you're like Googling Mayfair magazine, don't do it at work. I tried to find these sources.
Yeah.
I will link to everything that I did find in the show note.
That's
Google
that's
on your own time.
I wish I was there to witness that.
Yeah, it was more than a little
was
surprising.
It at work?
No, it
okay,
wasn't.
Okay.
And then another one was a periodical called Notes and Queries. Now, a quote from an article published in the 1970s, the Notes and Queries, states that the story of the haunted house in Mayfair can be recapitulated in a few words. The house contains at least one room of which the atmosphere is supernaturally fatal to body and mind. Dun, dun, dun. Now, in 1873, a shocking discovery is made. The house is not vacant at all.
What?
It simply appears to be.
So now, there is someone with a candle that stubbed their toe.
There is somebody with a candle stubbing their toe. They're not stubbing their toe. Essentially, and what would happen as well if people got the guts up to go ding dong ditch the house, not ding dong ditch it. I'm gonna say they probably had more class than that, to knock on the door and be like, hello. Ghosts.
When did doorbells become much of a thing, though?
I don't know.
Didn't they just have door knockers?
Sure.
For the longest time?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
No, knock, knock.
Boo?
No. Anyway, it'd be like Ding Dong Ditch. We need something that starts with an N. Knock, knock, leave. Anyway, if somebody had the guts to go up and knock on the door and try to figure out who lived there and what's going on, someone would answer the door. It was like this old, crusty old butler dude, and he would just answer the door, and they'd be like, oh, hello, and he would be like, what can I help you with? And they'd be like, nothing at all, actually. I'm very sorry. And then they'd leave. But they never saw this person go into the house or out of the house or anything like that. But
wow, such nosy neighbors.
I know, right?
Leave the poor fellow alone.
In 1873, a shocking discovery was made. The house was not vacant at all.
Isn't that what you just said?
And as well as that, the owner, this is how they figured that out.
Okay, okay.
The owner was being sued for not paying his taxes and property fees.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Now the man...
The appearance of vacancy.
Yes. The man never appeared at his hearing. The magistrate dismissed the case. Now, some people say he dismissed the case because he's like, well, he's living in a haunted house. I don't want to bring that into this courtroom. I think what it actually is that he died very shortly after this. So maybe they were like, I'm not going to come in and pay these taxes because I'm about to die and I have better things to do with my time, like wail in the night.
Whoa.
And the magistrate said, yeah, that's totally fair.
Yeah, you're right. You don't owe us anything.
You're right. Now, basically, these reports of this individual come in. We learn that his name is Mr. Myers. He himself, people say, is a big reason why this house got to be as big as it was. Essentially, people refer to him as eccentric and eclectic and all these different little words that mean weirdo in 19th century
Perfect.
London. Yeah. Basically, it seems to indicate that there's something undesirable about his mental state, but not much is actually known about who he is, where he came from, where he goes. And it stayed that way for a long time until 1906. Now, according to the biography of one Lady Dorothy Neville, Mr. Myers was a relative of hers. Now, the reason, she said, for his odd behavior was the loss of a fiancé. Now, Myers, now identified as Thomas Myers, was found to be the son of a parliamentarian. They had purchased, I think it was actually his father had purchased the house for him and his, or for his son and his son's fiance shortly before the wedding day.
Aw.
And Thomas filled it with everything that he could to bring joy to his new wife, complete with new furniture, carpets, china, everything. However,
he sounds like a pushover.
He sounds like he wanted to make the love of his life happy, Jason.
Yeah, you're right. That's what I meant.
Now, days before the wedding, his fiance ran off with another man, and this ruined Thomas Myers. Myers retreated to the highest level of the home and locked himself away in the room up there. The only time that he came out was in the dead of night. This is so melodramatic. He comes out in the dead of night to carry a candle and wail the name of his long-gone fiancée. Now, he left the house exactly how it had been at the moment that he heard the news that ruined his life. So even like...
Oh, come on, man.
Well, even like...
Poor dude.
It was found that he, you know, he had bought like rugs and stuff, and he had put them up against the wall and said, ah, just leave them against the wall. We'll just do it when we get married. We'll unveil the rug. It'll be great. And it just stayed up against the wall for 20 years. Like that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He did not disrupt anything in the home. And this leads to the state that it was reported on in an issue of the weekly community magazine, Mayfair, not the other one. This was in 1879. It says, with windows caked and blackened by dust, full of silence and emptiness, and yet no notice about it anywhere that it may have been for renting, this is known as the haunted house in Berkeley Square. Now, it's interesting to note, as we mentioned, that in this situation, the house itself has a connection to the late, great Charles Dickens, or as our friend RJ over at Oh No Lit Class calls him, I think he calls him Charlie Dickey.
Oh, please don't.
I love it. He called him like Charlie Dickey, then C. Dickey. I can't remember the other ones.
Oh, gosh. Awesome. Okay.
If any of our listeners have read the book Great Expectations, and if they haven't, I recommend you listen to Oh No Lit Class's episode on Great Expectations. You may be familiar with the eccentric character of Miss Havisham.
I hated her. I hated her so much.
She's awful.
I think that's probably why I don't like Great Expectations, is just the taste I get into my mouth with Miss Havisham.
Just
after
me saying
it. After I say that, it hurts.
I agree. I understand. But she is a woman who is abandoned by her fiancé and lives the rest of her life, like, even in, she stays in her wedding gown.
Yes, with a G.
Gown. Wedding gown for the rest of her life. And she keeps everything in the home exactly how it was. She even stops the clocks to 20 minutes to 9, which was the exact moment that she heard that her fiancé had abandoned her, essentially. And then she trains up like this girl so that she can destroy men the way that a man destroyed her, basically.
I swear, it's like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, except back in the 1800s.
Now, a colleague of Dickens's, James Payne, he claimed that Dickens fashioned the character of Miss Havisham after somebody that he had told Dickens about. And indeed, Dickens did use real-life people as inspirations for his characters all the time. Now, it's impossible to prove this at this late a date, but it seems more than possible between James Payne's connection to Dickens and to the Myers family, it seems more than possible that the inspiration for Mrs. Havisham is not a woman at all, but was rather Thomas Myers, who, like we said, kept the house exactly the same. In Great Expectations, now we talked about like the rug and all of that.
Yeah.
In Great Expectations, Havisham like leaves the wedding feast out. And it just molds.
Yeah,
for
decays.
Years.
Yeah.
And
that's just a health hazard.
It is a health hazard. But that's how you kind of rub up against Charles Dickens on this one. Not anything
well, that's
big,
cool, though.
But
so we have actually like a real life thing that occurs and it inspires fiction.
Yeah. It's pretty neat.
Stuff.
And there's another way that this links to Charles Dickens as well. It's a little bit silly, but in one of the
more recent pop culture.
Yes, more recent pop culture. In one of the more recent games, I don't know, of Assassin's Creed, I think this one was Syndicate.
Syndicate, yeah.
Okay.
That was the London-based.
Yeah, you go into this house. You go in with Charles Dickens into number 50 Berkeley Square, and you, like, I don't know if you kill a ghost or something, but... You kill something.
Okay.
And
I'm going to have to look that up on YouTube after this.
Yeah.
Take a
I came
quick
across
peek at
that.
It.
So it's something, it's in the, you know, it's in the minds of the people. It's in the folklore of the area. It's very, very easy to say, and a lot of skeptics say that the entire reason people think this house is haunted in the first place is because of Thomas Myers, and that if it had just passed into the hands of another normal person, it would have been totally fine. There was never any ghosts or anything like that. But we do have a little bit of evidence that the spookernatural activity predates Thomas Myers. And one of the people who helped to bring that to light is actually an individual named Harry Price, who some of our listeners may remember him as Jeff the Talking Mongoose's arch nemesis, who, as Jeff referred to him as the man who puts the kibosh on spirits. And he was basically an old-timey paranormal investigator.
I love him.
You love Harry Price?
I already love him.
Oh, dude, he's great. He was.
I'm imagining, like, Sherlock Holmes, but with spooks.
Yeah, that's pretty much. And I think that they actually made a TV show. They made a TV show about him, same premise.
Yeah, they just ruined it all for me.
They did exactly what I was thinking. But yeah, so he went and investigated Jeff the Talking Mongoose way back when. At another time, he went and he investigated number 50 Berkeley Square. And it was him who really found accounts of activity going back before Thomas Myers. He found accounts of activity going back to at least 1790 in the home, which is most likely right about when it had just been built. So it's worth noting that as far as I can tell here, before we really dive into all these spooks, the ownership of the house is definitely documented. It's not extremely well documented because you have multiple owners over the years. You have also the fact that between George Canning and Miss Curzon, it kind of was empty for a time, or there was a landlord mm-hmm. and he lent it out and back. And then
I feel like a lot of the information about this place has been kind of consumed by the folklore that surrounds it.
Yeah, for sure as well. But then you also have times where even when people, like, we'll get into this, you'll hear me say, like, in this year, this happened. And it sounds like, oh, well, that was the time when, especially, like, Miss Curzon lived there. So how can that be true? Well, like many, many, many wealthy people in Britain at the time, she had a home in the country and a home in the city. And so it stood vacant for about half the time when she lived there anyway. But we're going to go ahead.
Okay.
You just keep that all in mind.
I've got it. It's locked away in here.
And we're gonna dig in. Now, here's something interesting.
Ooh, what you got?
Something I never thought I'd say. The standard ghosts and apparitions that one sees in a haunted house, the visual and audible manifestations are not the reason we're talking about this house. We're not talking about this haunted house because of the ghosts. That's basically what I'm saying.
Why?
We're going to talk about
it. The reason that we talk about things is for the spooks.
We're going to talk about it, but there is a greater spook than your normal spooks in this house. Anyway, but it's so important to understanding this house that we're going to tell some of these ghost stories.
Hey, I just had an idea.
Uh-huh.
Hey Price in the Chamber of Poltergeists.
Terrible. All right. Now, according to the author, Jessie Adelaide Middleton, she wrote this book called The Gray Ghost Book, which was published in 1912. Reports of a small Scottish child being seen in the house go as far back as the late 1700s. Now, the girl was supposedly killed by a monster of a nanny and had been seen dressed in traditional Scottish clothing, wailing in the room that she was killed in, which, you're going to hear us talk about this room a lot, it is the room on the top floor of the home where Myers would lock himself away for 14 straight years only to come out and howl in the night. This is...
Maybe he was a werewolf.
It's possible. The other... That's the other kind of interesting thing about number 50 Berkeley Square. The house itself is not necessarily haunted. That room at the top of the house is the only place activity ever happens. It's that room that is haunted more than anything else. And another ghost said to inhabit that space is that of a young woman named Adeline. She was said to have committed suicide to escape the lecherous hands of a vile uncle. And people...
Oh, gosh.
I know, right? It's terrible. It's terrible. People would report seeing her, like, holding on to the ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And screaming and then letting go and hitting the ground. And then she's gone because she's a ghost. So that would happen in the same area as well. You also have this idea that supernatural writing would appear on the wall in that room just out of nowhere. And there was one individual, this one's completely unnamed, we don't really know anything about him, but one individual supposedly who sat and waited in that room to see the writing appear. And something finally did appear. It wasn't what he wanted. He went crazy, killed himself in that room. So that room's haunted for there.
And oh my gosh, that's a crazy magic eight ball.
Right. It's a terrible eight ball.
Ask again later. No, just dead. Screw it.
I mean, if you're waiting that long to get an answer from the spirits, you gotta get other things
well,
on your mind.
Well, wasn't this the time where, like, seances were super popular as well for the wealthy?
Spiritualism in the 19th century, in Victorian era, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
so why wouldn't you just have a seance instead of staring at a wall?
Well, for one thing, seances aren't real, but
and walls are. So there
walls
you go.
That's
logic.
A wall. I don't know that, because the other thing is we don't know when this individual was in the house, so it could have been before the Victorian era of seances and all of that. It's possible, but and then of course you have Myers himself. who shortly after his death on some unspecified date in the 1870s was said to continue walking through the home, wailing and with his candle, just like before. Now, Harry Price himself, during the investigation, uncovered many other stories told by neighbors, and the ones that intrigued him the most took place not during the time in which Myers inhabited the house, or even necessarily when it was uninhabited for long periods of time, but instead it was during the time that Miss Curzon owned the property. And like we said, she owned multiple homes, spent time in and out of the house frequently, intermittently going forward. And it's important to note that although the public and the general knowledge about the house started to turn when Thomas Myers was in it, the neighbors had been seeing things for a long time before the newspapers started writing about it. Now, according to the neighbors, especially when one or more of them had physically seen Miss Curzon leave the home, this activity would start. And they knew that it was uninhabited. They would hear strange auditory phenomena, things like it was like the sound of furniture being dragged and thrown against walls. They would hear bells ringing incessantly out of the home.
Probably why that butler is such a bad mood.
Right?
I'm coming, master.
Master. Now, one neighbor, he hears these bells, right, accompanied by thumps and this and that. And the bells are just ringing nonstop for like hours in the middle of the night.
Are we talking cowbell or more like cat bell?
No, it's like
a kitty bell.
It's like the kind of bell where you
like
would
like a serving bell. Be like,
yeah, it's literally the bell for the servants. Ah. Yeah, they would have like this system where in their room they'd like hit a button and then it would cause the bell to ring.
Wow, they didn't even like ring the bell themselves. They hit a button in order to ring the bell.
Well, I don't know at that point because I think that was with electricity. I don't know how they did it. Anyway, and all of the bells went down to the same area, the butler's pantry or the servants' quarters. And that, therefore, whenever they rang any bell in any room, they would hear it down there. And basically, they were hearing these bells nonstop. So this neighbor goes in, he breaks into the house, because he's also just kind of worried, like, oh, what if someone is in the house and they're dying or something and nobody's helping them? And so he goes down in the servants' quarters to find out which room was ringing, and he sees all of the bells going at once, and he's like, I'm getting out of here, actually.
That sounds like a Hallmark Christmas movie.
If someone is going to die, let them die. I'm outie. And so he was outie five thoutie. He got out alive, I guess. And
well, of course, he has to tell a story.
And it were these sorts of stories that Harry Price heard that really convinced him something was going on there beyond the little Scottish girl and this and that. He also heard stories of, remember that $10 word from the black monk of Pontefract? I think it was like transubstantiation or something like that.
Did you say $10 word?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What do you mean? $10 word?
You know, like a $10 word, like what? A fancy word.
Oh, $10 gets you something fancy?
Anyway, okay. And it, like, basically, the ghosts,
yes,
would be able to make objects appear, right? Like, do you remember the eggs with the black monk of Pontefract?
Yes.
She put the eggs in the box, and then they showed up in the air in front of her and hit the ground?
Right.
Okay, you probably don't. That's okay.
It's probably mold.
Oh, for goodness sakes. This would happen in front of number 50 Berkeley Place as well, or number 50 Berkeley Square.
So stuff was just, like, appearing?
Like, shoes would appear and then hit the ground, and rocks and pebbles and stuff, to the point where it kind of seemed like people were just throwing it out of the house, but the windows weren't open, and people were watching this happen, and them just appear out of thin air. This is the stuff that Harry Price referred to as good poltergeist stuff running true to type. That's some of that good old poltergeist.
I love it.
Now, like we've mentioned multiple times, typically a poltergeist is associated in some way with an adolescent child or a pubescent or prepubescent child, primarily a young girl, which while there are ghosts of young girls and stuff like that, there was never actually a living
No one for it to haunt.
Yeah, no one for it to haunt. It didn't have anybody to terrorize. And therefore, it's a little bit dicey if it's a poltergeist or if it's just normal geist, I guess.
What's the... Okay, they're all...
Your normal
they're all
spirits.
Ghosts.
Your normal ghost, okay is something that you see and you have a visual representation. You see, like, the little girl, right? The little girl in the Scottish kilt yelling. She wouldn't be a poltergeist. She's just a normal ghost.
Okay.
Right. So
that's, I love the differentiation.
Yeah. I'm sure that there's like an actual classification system here that I'm not aware of. But as we mentioned, these old ghost stories are simply periphery to some of the biggest spooks documented in the home. And if true, they could be some of the few cases wherein supernatural activity actually did lead from point A to point B. Point B being death, as mentioned in the Notes and Queries periodical in 1870s.
That was so menacing. All right, Sam, so hit me with the big old spooks.
Here's the thing about it. I'd love to tell you what we're talking about. I'd love to say this is the name of the thing we're talking about. But our primary subject for the haunting of 50 Berkeley Square, it doesn't have a name. Its name is... The Nameless Thing.
Wow. That's
it's
awesome. That's creative.
It's awesome. I love it. And the Nameless Thing did not rear its head until 1840, during the time in which the house was passing between a few different owners before being owned by Miss Curzon. Now, this account focuses on the death of one Sir Robert Warboys. It is unclear.
That's a sweet last name.
It is a sweet last name. It is unclear whether this individual existed ever. I will be completely honest.
It's one of these stories. Okay.
There
All
is
right.
more than enough for there to be actually, more than enough evidence for there to actually be something going on to the point where I don't have to lie about this. I don't think this guy necessarily existed. But.
So when I say, like, grain of salt, it's more like get out that Himalayan rock salt lamp and. That's
yes,
really what
that's
we're working
the
with.
Grain you need to say. I understand what you're saying. And one of the main reasons is you have so many different variances in this story. Some people say Thomas Warboys, some people say Robert Warboys, some people say Sir Robert or Sir Thomas. I couldn't find any sort of obituary, but I also couldn't just find any record of him. I mean, I was looking through these papers in London.
And I mean, that is one of the tough parts about, you know, a story that were 150 years
ago.
Oh,
yeah.
So
it's rough.
It makes sense.
It's entirely possible that this is true. But I was looking through these papers in London, and anytime there was a noble person or a gentleman, they documented the movements of these people like a hawk watching a mouse. Like,
yeah, like
literally,
the internet now and celebrities.
Yeah. Literally, have you heard the term of like, oh, it's a real who's who of the whatever?
Yeah.
Who's who?
Yeah.
That's an actual thing.
What?
The who's who.
Like that
was
a
periodical.
Of a real thing.
Yeah. The
wow,
who's
that's
who
cool.
was a periodical about like the noble people. And this is the first baron
so
of whatever.
The,
and he's married
who's
to that
who
person.
Of Berkeley Square.
Yes. And
ooh.
Sir Robert Warboys. No, you wouldn't. Nah. It'd be so boring. Sir Robert Warboys is in none of the who's who's. He's not in the paper at all.
Ooh.
I couldn't find anything about
it. I love me a mysterious man.
Okay. But like Jason said, we're so far out. It's impossible to say for sure. The story though goes this way. Okay. In a pub in the nearby Holborn district of London.
That's where they all start.
This man, no good story ever starts anywhere else.
It's always in a pub.
This man, we'll go with Sir Robert Warboys, that's what we'll call him. He was getting very drunk. And as he was doing this, his compatriots were trying their best to spook him and to spook each other and telling all these spooky stories. When talk finally turned to number 50 Berkeley Square. Now, it's not known exactly which stories were told, but whatever they were, Warboys, who was known to be hot-headed and skeptical, just like Jason, responded much the same way.
Excuse me?
responded much the same way that I
hot-headed,
think...
Hot-headed, you say?
that I think Jason would with pure those are fight derision. Words. This is what I'm talking about when you're being hot-headed. He responds with pure derision. He just, oh, that's stupid.
It is.
That's dumb. There's no such thing as ghosts.
I don't know what you mean by hot-headed.
And his friends bicker with him and argue with him, and they're like, no, dude, ghosts are totally real, and this house has a bad case of the ghosties. And he says, fine, I'm going to prove to you that it's not true. And he runs, and his friends are all running, following him through the streets to number 50 Berkeley Square.
See, the last time I ran drunk in the streets, I fell. So already, right. I don't believe the story.
Now, they all ran, all of them ran to the door of the house and began, and Robert began banging on it. Now, the landlord, which is a real thing, because Miss Curzon, she didn't actually own the house. She just leased the house. So it's entirely possible that while she was leasing it, the landlord might live in it while she was out or anything like that. But the landlord opens the door and he says, what is it? It's like 2 a.m. And Robert says, I'm going to sleep in your house, which is a strange thing to say to a person at 2 a.m. But he,
that's a bit forward.
Yeah, it is. He explains this whole idea of like, we have to settle this bet. I have to do this. I'm sorry if it's inconvenient, but this is what's going on. And the landlord essentially just keeps saying, you don't really want to do this. Don't do this. This is silly. Don't be dumb. And it's like, he's getting more and more desperate. And then finally Robert says, I will not be dissuaded. I am sleeping in this house one way or the other.
Like all drunkards do. Yes.
And he finally, the landlord finally says, all right, two conditions. One, if you see anything, you need to ring the bell in the room and let me know. And two, you need to have a pistol on you. You can't go in here unarmed.
So wait a second. We're giving a drunk man a pistol.
Yes.
So whatever he sees, he just shoot.
Yes.
And secondly, we're putting a bell in a house that's notorious for ringing bells.
Well, the bells are already there.
All right.
That's what I'm
okay.
saying. It's the same bell that they would ring
exactly.
when they needed something.
What? The house is notorious for ringing bells. It happens frequently.
And therefore,
and
the house shouldn't be trusted with bells?
Exactly.
It's a terrible
idea. It could
be
a trap from the ghosts.
It's true. Now, Robert says, fine, you just make me carry a gun, see if I care. And so he does, and he goes up, and the landlord gets him all situated.
Now he tucks him in?
Yeah, gives him a kiss on the cheek, in for a wonderful night. And the landlord says, okay, remember, ring the bell and shoot anything you
see. Sets him up with a glass of water and a bucket near the bed.
There you go. And Robert says, yeah, sure, I'm going to be fine. And the landlord goes downstairs. I'm sure he's just up with fright. He's just nervous. And suddenly the bell starts ringing. And about a second after the bell starts ringing, he hears a gunshot. And then the bell stops ringing.
Oh, man.
Now he runs
up. Probably killed the thing.
He runs up the stairs to the top floor. Again, the same room in the top floor. And he busts open the door. Robert Warboys was not on the bed as he had left him, but instead he had backed into a corner, his pistol aiming at the opposite wall. The barrel of the pistol was still smoking, and with a look of abject terror on his face, he had crumpled to the ground, dead.
Cured of life.
Good. Killed by the sheer fright of it.
And we had one less drunk in the world.
Now, there's some more stories here that we're going to get a little bit further into this, but before we do, we're going to go ahead. We're going to take a break for our sponsors. Now, you've heard me talking about videoblocks.com for a few weeks now, but they have outdone themselves again and come out with a brand new offer for the listeners of the Not Alone podcast, valid for this holiday season only. Now, for the same price that you'd pay to access VideoBlocks' huge library of stock video footage, you now get access to all three of the StoryBlocks media libraries. Now, that's right. For just $149, you can get access, all the access to your heart's content of not only video, but also stock audio and still image content, all included in that one price of your subscription, essentially tripling the value of your Storyblock subscription. You're going to be able to get literally hundreds of thousands of images, audio, and video clips all included with the price of that subscription, as well as huge discounts on any premium clips, anything out of their creator libraries. And you can feel good about it because anything that you do end up paying for, that money goes right into the pocket of the creator themselves. Using the Storyblocks.com media libraries, there is no reason that your production has to look anything less than the absolute best it can. Everything from B-roll footage to entire sound theme scores for your production are all available under this amazing deal at this amazing price. But it's only good through the holiday season, only good through December. So make sure you jump over as soon as you can. As soon as you hear this message, just open it up on your smartphone, tablet, desktop, laptop, Apple Watch, I don't care. Just go to videoblocks.com/notalone. That's videoblocks.com/notalone. I guarantee it's not only worth your time, it's worth your money, and it is going to take your production from being a amateur labor of love, well-intentioned, but definitely a hobby, and make it into something that can compete and stand out from the crowd of other independent content creators out there. So head on over. Again, that's videoblocks.com/notalone. I guarantee it's worth it. All right, let's get back to the show. This, of course, is a very hard story to swallow, like we said, but it is worth noting that this story has been around since at least the 1870s. So one of the things that I decided early on in this was that I was most likely not going to be able to find firsthand accounts, and that instead of trying to focus on that, I just needed to try to find how far back these stories go and see, because if I can't find any like reference of this before 1950, then it's almost undoubtedly untrue. Whereas the further back we go, the more possible that there's something to it. It may not be completely true, but there's something to it. And in this aforementioned Notes and Queries article that spoke of one of the rooms being supernaturally fatal to mind and body, it followed that up by saying this, which is, quote, "A gentleman, a disbeliever in ghosts, dared to sleep in number 50 and was found a corpse in the middle of the floor after frantically ringing for help in vain. Rumor suggests other cases of the same kind, all ending in death, madness, or both, as a result of sleeping or trying to sleep in that room."
See, unquote. Now we're getting different information. First off, this man was not a gentleman.
Well, he could have been. Secondly, if he was a sir. He was Sir Robert.
He was in the corner of the room, not okay. In the middle of the floor.
So
get your information correct,
sir. Thank you. Now, another story is referenced in the same article in its preceding sentence. It says, "A girl saw, heard, and felt such horror in it that she went mad and never recovered sanity enough to tell how or why." Now, this story comes from around 1879, the same article, or the same year that this article came out, and another one, which was recorded by, again, the weekly family-friendly adult, not adult, the weekly family-friendly Mayfair magazine, which I found that one as well, and its most recent episode was like, how to look good while shooting things wearing leather. And it was like, okay, that seems like a very British gentry sort
to
of...
To be completely honest, yeah, you always look good things while covered in leather.
Now, it's in this article as well, or in this newspaper as well as the Notes and Queries, that you get this story, which comes from 1879. And again, while I wasn't able to find like obituaries and things like that, the fact that all of these people are brazenly claiming that these articles are claiming that this happened in this same year, it is a bit interesting. So the story basically goes like this. After After Myers died, the house sat vacant for a little bit longer, which this is confirmed by his cousin, who said that she basically inherited the house, wanted to keep it empty, but then after a few years just decided to get rid of it. And it's purchased by this older gentleman who has two daughters. Now, as they're moving in, all three of the family members complain of smelling something musty. They say it kind of smells like the smell of animal cages at the zoo. And they sent to the top floor their maid in order to prepare that room as a guest room.
So how many floors are we talking about?
It's a four-story building. Okay. Yeah, four-story building. So they say, okay, maid, it smells weird in here.
Okay, maid.
Go up to the top room, get that place cleaned out, because we're going to have Captain Kentfield come and stay with us.
Ooh.
Which is another interesting thing about it.
Captain Kentfield.
You have the idea that Captain Kentfield is called by name in the same year that this story happens that it's printed. So the maid says, okay, I'm going to go up because Captain Kentfield is the daughter's fiance.
Ooh.
And so one of them. And so I need to make sure this place is spick and span. And she's up there for just a few minutes when the family hears screaming, just blood curdling screams. And the father dashes upstairs. He's thinking, oh, what if this, you know, a transient made this their home in the last 6 years or so. He dashes upstairs and he finds the maid in the corner, and she's just screaming, don't let it touch me, over and over and over. And they finally have to rip her out of there, and they get her to an asylum. And it's said that the next day she dies in the asylum, and she never was able to articulate what she saw or why she was in such a state.
Spooky.
Now, the daughter's fiance, Captain Kentfield, he comes regardless. And when he does, he stays in this room regardless. I'm pretty sure they even said, like, hey, you don't have to stay up there. First off, it smells like the animal cages at the zoo. Secondly, my maid went crazy. So maybe you should stay, like, down on the couch or something like that. And he's like, I'm no wuss. It's fine. Now, just like Mr./Robert/Thomas Warboys,
mm-hmm.
He as well was like, I ain't afraid of no ghost, but I'm still going to take a gun with me regardless.
Because everyone knows ghosts can be shot and killed.
Yeah, you have to. Now, in the dead of night, the family's all sleeping, a gunshot goes off. And they say, oh no, what was that? They all go upstairs, ready to fight off something. And there, in the corner of the room, is Captain Kentfield, dead of fright. Not a scratch on him.
So here is his problem. He loaded the gun with a normal bullet. Everyone knows it should be rock salt.
That's true. And it needs to be a shotgun.
I mean,
obviously.
This is clearly why he screwed up and died.
Yes. Now, after this, of course, the family did not stay long. They vacated. Captain Kentfield was buried and dead. And like I said, these stories, some of them, especially the Robert Warboys, these three stories, really in general, they kind of stretch belief a little bit to the point where that just sounds like too good of a ghost story. And that's part of it. Doing 42 episodes worth of research, I am now aware that usually things aren't that good of a story. Like
they are
just raw coming out of it.
They're fantastic ghost stories.
They are fantastic ghost stories.
I did look a little bit about getting scared to death.
Ooh, yeah.
Yes. Which, I mean, it's essentially, and it doesn't have to even be fright. It's really just being in a heightened state of adrenaline.
Ooh,
so, you know, it's the fight or flight. So any kind of emotion can really do this to you.
Okay.
Even I've seen reports of people like going into a house that smells horrible and then having a minor heart attack from it.
What happens
is when you do have that heightened level and adrenaline gets released into your body, calcium also can kind of hit your heart,
uh-huh.
Which is weird. I don't know why calcium is what does it, but essentially what it does is it makes it so that your heart can't relax again. So you get arrhythmia issues with your heart, and that can cause you to later die, which is probably what happened to the maid in some regards, if that story is true. That she did get terrified, and because of the heightened level of adrenaline, it took a while for her to actually die because she never was able to relax her heart again, and she had a heart attack.
So, but you're saying that from a medical scientific standpoint, these things are possible.
Yeah, you can get scared to death.
Dang,
you can also
sucks.
Get excited to death. So I mean, that's what happens every once in a while when encounters occur.
Yes.
But yeah, it's
like
it's,
in, if I may add, like in Downton Abbey.
Or the Mayfair, Mayfair magazine.
No, I'm
or Gentlemen.
Downton Abbey. It's a little more scandalous than you thought.
So the calcium.
It's a good show, Jason.
In your blood. After you get
Start
hit with
again.
A
Say the calcium
huge,
again.
So when the calcium in your blood hits your heart after you got a huge, massive increase in adrenaline, stresses your heart out to where it can't relax its muscle, and then you have irregular heartbeats, you have heart attacks occur either immediately or shortly after.
Interesting.
Which is the fun part.
That's the fun part.
Yeah.
The dying of it. Okay. So do you...
So
interesting.
Yeah.
So it can be triggered by smell.
It's honestly, it's literally anything that can trigger an adrenaline-like reaction for you. So it could be, again, excitement. It doesn't have to necessarily be fear, but that is the reason why we have death by fright.
Interesting. I appreciate that, and I enjoy that.
But I never saw anything about their faces being glued the way that they were when they died.
Being glued?
Yeah, you said like they had images of pure terror
on
their face.
Oh, yeah, like screwed up faces. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Not like actually
never,
like glued something to their face.
No. But like being stuck in the way that they are frightened to death.
Yes.
I haven't found anything for that.
Well, it's very much like that's how it was with the Orang Medan, right? They found the ghost ship of the China Sea, South Sea. And everybody there, their faces were just
terrified,
which I feel like if you died with your face in that way, it might stay that way. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I feel like your muscles, especially like in your cheeks or anything like that, would relax again.
Go slack. Okay. Possibly. I agree with you. You're not wrong. I don't know. I'm not
a
doctor.
That's
Let us know. I know we have like a few different medical people.
People that know more than me.
Yeah.
I love those kind of people.
Let us know if that's something that happens. That's super interesting. Now,
also, it doesn't really matter if you're in proper health or not. Even if you're a tip-top athlete, you can still experience things like that.
I am going to die of fright at the concept of dying in fright.
Or me, you
Just
know, looking
like
through your window with a wolf
mask
on.
Brain aneurysms, dude. The fact that there can be something just waiting to pop every time I sneeze. That's spooky, man.
Sam, it's going to be okay.
I'm scared.
I'll continue this in your memory.
Thanks, dude. It'll be fine. Anyway, back to real life. And by real life, I mean haunted houses. Woo!
That's real enough for you.
Now, while all of these accounts lack certain things that we like from historical eyewitnesses accounts, things like reliable names of people, firm specific
Our eyewitness
dates,
not being dead.
Yeah, living eyewitnesses. These would all be nice things. Now, while we do have a lot to desire from that, there are actually individuals. There were two individuals who were said to have had an encounter in this house and to survive it, and to come out and say, this is what I saw, and this is what happened. One of whom was a aristocrat and politician who was a gentleman named Lord George Littleton. Now, in 1872, he stayed in this top floor room again on a bet. The interesting thing about this is that so many of these stories all incorporate
a bet. He was probably at the pub first.
Probably.
And then a bet.
But they all incorporate aspects of each other.
Right.
The bet from Robert Warboys and then the dying of fright from Robert Warboys.
It's
it
like
makes
they
it
just
muddy.
Keep getting retold somehow.
Right? Who would
different characters
do that? Now, in 1872, he stayed in this top floor room. He is supposedly one of two people to see what was causing the insanity in this room and live to tell about it. He was laying in the bed in the room, attempting to get some sleep when he noticed a mist roll into the room coming in from under the door. Now, what he described seeing next, unable to say whether the door had actually been opened or not, was a large brown mass of tentacles thriving and coming towards him. Now, some reports state that the creature leapt through the air towards him, and when it did, he fired his gun and heard something flump onto the floor. He was blinded temporarily by the flash of the gun and was also very, very, very scared, and so he did not look for the creature until morning. When he did, he found absolutely nothing other than his bullet, which was buried in the opposing wall. This is what the nameless thing of Berkeley Square is said to be.
Mm-hmm.
This mass of tentacles, this monster that's Lovecraftian, very cosmic horror from outer space. It's awesome. And it is, like I said, that is what we're talking about, why we're talking about Berkeley Square. Obviously, everything else is great too, the ghost stories. But this thing has been around in popular culture since at least the 1870s. And it continues to this day. Now, there are a few other people, though.
That's just in adult Japanese magazines.
Oh, no. There are a few other people, one other person primarily, who is said to have seen the horror of Berkeley Square. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, I saw it, or, you know, they'll say my brother's friends, this and that. But again, names, dates, these are the things we need.
Mm-hmm.
And really the only other account of the nameless thing in Berkeley Square comes from the story of two sailors, one Edward Blunden and Robert Martin.
I swear, if you call them gentlemen.
What?
They're sailors.
They could be gentlemen.
Probably not.
They're probably not. Now, essentially, these were two sailors who were stationed aboard the HMS Penelope. And they were on shore leave for Christmas Eve with no friends or family with whom to stay in London.
Aww.
So they went to the bar and they got drunk.
How all good stories begin.
All good stories start. They wander through the streets looking for a place to sleep. They come across number 50 Berkeley Square. And they notice a big for or to let sign, right? Right? Yeah. To let is how they say it, which is basically for rent in British.
Oh.
And
the
they
language
say,
our language is derived off of.
Yeah. Perfect. Not really noticing the yellowing with age and the terrible condition of the home. They say, yeah,
well,
let's
they're
sleep
drunk
here.
So
and they don't have any money for it. And so they say, okay, we're just going to break in a little bit. It's fine.
It's good B&E. That's what I'm all about.
It's empty, so it'll be fine. They also just couldn't have contacted the owner this late. It's just the right thing to do, is to break into the house.
What? Okay.
Yes.
Sure.
Now, they get inside, and the ground level is it's fairly damp. And they say, well, this is no good for Christmas. And so
we need a tree in here, of course.
And they decide to go up to the very top floor. Once they do, they get to the fourth floor, and they get to this room.
Why all the way to the fourth floor?
Because it's damp in the bottom floor, and therefore the fourth floor is going to be the least damp.
I don't know.
They just go up the stairs. What a terrible hole to be seeing. Now, essentially, they come into this room, they lay down, they go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, I think it's Blunden.
Is Big Spoon?
Yeah. Blunden, no. Blunden feels uneasy. And says, you know, I just don't feel like this is really a good thing to be doing right now. And Martin says, oh, you sissy, it's fine. Just get over it. They're a little uneasy. They fall asleep a few minutes later. It's fine, you know. They sleep soundly for a few hours until they are awakened. And what wakes them up is the door slamming open. Something is coming through it, and Martin and Blunden both see a brownish mass of tentacles scurrying through the door. Immediately, it sprang onto Blunden, wrapped its tentacles around his neck, and choked him out. The other sailor, Martin, was paralyzed with fear for a moment and then ran out of the house to find a policeman. The cop came back with him, slightly puzzled and also irritated by this drunkard, but followed him back into the home nonetheless. When they went up the stairs, preparing to fight Blunden's assailant, they found absolutely nothing in the room, and therefore they made a detailed search of the entire house. They found Blunden's body in the basement, and his neck was broken, and his face had been twisted in fear. Now, this as well kind of deviates from the mythos. Everybody else dies without a scratch on him. Blunden is choked to death, and his neck is broken.
Yeah, it's
by
pretty brutal.
Something, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the two stories that we just heard are very, very similar to one another, with some sort of thing coming mm-hmm. from the doorway and leaping onto one of the people.
Yes, yes, and you have that idea. Well, are they similar because it's people telling stories and this and that, or are they similar because something happened? You know, the reports of these people actually matched up. Now, up until now, like I said, the house was vacated in 2015. It's unknown who actually owns it right now. I saw a few people from that area actually like talking on a message board among themselves about how it was going to go up for auction, which some people are kind of excited about, in the idea that if a common man can get in there, if somebody who knows the story can get in there during the auction, after the auction, anything like that, and take some pictures of this room, it may help out. So if you're able to do that without trespassing, you should do that. But essentially, the Maggs brothers claim that there was absolutely no indication of supernatural activity in the property since they bought it back in 1937. More than a few visitors to the store, have reported that there is a sign on the wall that says that the upper two levels of the store cannot be used for anything. Can't be used for storage, can't be used for residence, or anything like that.
Well, that's where that's the upper two, instead of just the highest most.
Yeah.
The topmost.
Yeah. I agree, it is strange.
Okay.
It's, and I mean, honestly,
maybe it's just because of the age of it, right?
Deterioration. Right. So, number 50 Berkeley Square back in 1998 was listed as the oldest still standing completely unaltered building. So it is entirely possible that it's simply structural safety concerns that they're worried about.
Splinters. You might stub your toe.
Or you might fall through two stories.
That's
that
fair.
Could happen
that's
as well.
Also scary.
Now, it's true that the phenomena did seem to die down with the turn of the century. However, there are still rumors of people having some sorts of paranormal experiences with the building. In July of 1937, a few months before Maggs brothers moved in, Mrs. Mary Balfour, a dignified, stately lady of Scottish descent, moved into a flat across the street from number 50. Now, one night, shortly after she moved in, her nurse said, "Come here. Look at this. Look at this. This is crazy. Come look at this. This is insane." I don't know if she said it that way. She says, "Come look at this." And Mrs. Balfour runs to the window. She and her maid or her nurse both claim to see a man standing in the window with a morose, ashen look on his face. And he was dressed in period inappropriate clothing, looking like he would have been home a lot more at home near the middle to end of the 19th century. The man then moved away from the window and disappeared, and when speaking with their neighbors in the following days, they learned that the building was currently unoccupied and that she had for sure seen a ghost. Others have reported seeing similar things in the dead of night, but for the most part, there have been no more crazy ghost hunting exploits or people dying of fright. Number 50 Berkeley Square appears to stand empty of supernatural activity, leaving instead just the normal, boring natural activity. And this detail about her being like, "Oh, I bought this house and I didn't know that the one across from it was haunted," it's actually not that far off. I was finding a lot of people. I went to so many different sites chasing up leads for this.
Well, we didn't know. Like, it doesn't sound like anything really happens after the 1870s.
Yeah.
And that's a 40-ish year gap.
Yeah.
So, that 70, makes sense.
60
that
to 70 years, yeah. Well, and so many people were saying that even...
I just can't count.
That's okay. Even to this day, when they mention the house to somebody, it's I mean, it's kind of like just how you and I, we know a lot more about paranormal stuff just in general because, like, we research it and we do this show and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah, yeah, okay. I do.
You kind of made a face like, oh, do I know more than that? Where it might be something that you and I have heard of a lot, but the average person hasn't. So
right.
People talk about, like, mentioning it to friends and workmates and stuff about, oh, yeah.
I mean, we're like a full lifespan apart.
Yeah.
Of happenings.
So, and even to this day, people say, oh, I had no idea that place was haunted, essentially, when people talk about it. So that makes sense. That's fine. There's been a whole lot of speculation, as you might expect, concerning the true nature of the events taking place at number 50 Berkeley Square. I'm sure we all have our own little theories about what's going on here, but it's worth noting that Harry Price, at the end of his own investigation, came up with his own conclusion. As we mentioned, Price had a feeling that a certain amount of the stories and accounts of the time period had to do with something real, some authentic poltergeist activity. However, he also suspected something else to be at work as well. He was able to uncover through his investigations and was backed up as well by the aforementioned Jesse Adelaide Middleton that there had been a group of counterfeiters and coin clippers operating in the bottom of number 50 Berkeley Square as early as 1790, just years after its original completion. Now, Price speculated that in a very spooky Scooby-Doo turn of events, the cause of these stories was the group of criminals making up spooky stories and spreading them.
And where else to spread spooky stories but at the local pub?
Right? Exactly. So that way people wouldn't mess with their counterfeiting operation, essentially.
And then it just, took a life of its own?
And then it just took a life of its own. But from there, that's where Price says, well, it's possible, but... I mean, there's been so much recorded and documented by people I claim to be reliable witnesses afterwards that there's got to be something else going on as well. Now, another quote from Notes and Queries pretty much sums it up as well. It says, "For the notorious stories about deaths and madness resulting from adventurous incursions into a particular room of the house, I have never heard any sufficient authority, but a mystery there is." So... I think that there's probably something going on here. One of the popular ideas is that it's an octopus.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an octopus.
It makes sense.
And that...
Have you ever seen an octopus jump, Sam?
I did on Finding Dory. Octopus can jump. I'm just saying. There's the idea that it's a freshwater octopus.
Octopus. That found its way into
the sewer.
Okay.
And then from there, use the sewer. Four floors up. And murdered some people. It's a gangster octopus, bro. It's good.
It murdered two people in the 1870s and then slithered back into sewers.
It makes sense, right? The octopus does. It's not immortal. It's not. It doesn't live forever. You know, it kind of fits. And then you say even beyond that, maybe there is some kind of spirit stuff going on there. There's some kind of ghost happening. And then you combine that with a murderous octopus, and this place is going to be, it's going to be in the history books forever. Right?
Hopefully.
Am I wrong?
Not. No. Hopefully well, it's not. Is it in a history book now? Where did you find this story, Sam?
A lot of places.
Okay.
There's a lot of
any
sources,
one of
actually.
Them history books?
No.
Okay. So, I rest my case.
It's just hard. This is one of the reasons I don't love doing urban legends, because at the end of the
because
day, it's like...
Because it's an urban legend.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, did it happen? I think the most compelling, single most compelling piece of article or evidence for me is the two articles, the one from Notes and Queries, the one from Mayfair Family Magazine. It's not called Mayfair Family Magazine, but the non-pornographic
sure you know which
Mayfair
one we're
Magazine.
About.
Yeah. The fact that these two articles came out the same year, referencing the same house, referring to the same person, in a time where, I mean, yeah, you could have, it would have been still hard to track people down, but... You could have, in theory, figured out who these people were or if there was a Captain Kent Phil back at the time. It just seems a little bold to me to be like, this happened last week. Go talk to people about it when it didn't happen. Why wouldn't you just put it back even further back into time immemorial like the rest, right? That's my biggest thing.
It's fresh.
Yeah, it is hot. It's fresh. It's straight out the kitchen.
Nope. No, it's not.
It's not. No.
I'm not chopping it up and serving it to you.
Okay. But that's, I don't know. That's my thing about it. What do you think?
I think that this house is, and our ghosts that inhabit it are only as live as people make them.
Okay.
I think that it is a part of folklore.
Yeah.
On that street.
Yeah. I think that's what it might come down to as well. So, in any case, there's a lot of spooks in that place.
A
so
wonderful folklore, but yes.
If you, if you are in the area, if you are able to, if they have an open house in a completely lawful setting or anything for you to get pictures of this room or of this house, please do. That would be great. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's just another one of those little stories. I don't know. I enjoyed it.
About octopus that eat people's faces.
About octopus that eat a person's face.
And drags them down into the basement.
Yeah, it's a good story at the end of the day. I think that it's probably been blown out of proportion. I like the idea that these counterfeiters and coin clippers
that
like,
sounds awesome.
Scooby-Dooed it up. Yeah, it's a great idea. But yeah, it's a good story.
Yeah, yeah, I appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah.
It was a fun murder house.
Fun murder house. Murder party. All right. Well, that's all I've got.
Awesome.
What do you got?
Anything else that we need to cover? I think that was it. I got to talk about adrenaline and what happens to your heart.
That was pretty good. That was like a little nice surprise. I didn't know you were going to be doing that.
Yeah. Sam, I do some stuff.
Do you?
I do.
I don't know about that.
Not only do I read your notes, but I also figure out what I want to talk about.
All right. All right. Next week, we are coming back with something that's a little more concrete and also a little more... While it is more concrete, it is also more open for discussion. We are not talking about golems, although we should sometime. That is a good idea. No, we next week are going to be talking about the most famous zombie in the world, who is a man named Clavius Narcisse, and Haitian voodoo, all of that. So that should be very good. I'm very excited for that. But... in the meantime, we do have a few other things we want to talk about this week. One of them is that we got a few different reviews this week, and it was really nice. And actually, like, all of them came in on the same day. They were all written.
Does that happen frequently?
No.
Or... Oh, okay. So very the reviews, not frequently. The reviews don't like just come in waves.
No. Okay. They're all independent, but this one, these three all came on the same day, which was interesting. So we want to thank Lantern Shadow. We want to thank C Diana 246.
Yes.
And we want to thank Desdemona. And then we're going to read Desdemona's because it really dovetails nicely with what we're looking at here. It says, whether you know about Cthulhu or are just on Team Giant Squid, hashtag Team Giant Squid. And then it says, oh, wait, I was just happy that Sam has the same level of Lovecraftian knowledge that I do. I am writing this finishing up an episode. This show is a really nice mix of skepticism and belief and relatable banter. Good. The banter is relatable, people. Remember that when you email. Now, the topics are spoopy and weird.
Spoopy?
Spoopy. And the hosts are really nice guys. Thank you so much, Desdemona. You're fantastic. And then we want to also thank, we got actually a few new... Patreon sponsors this week. We want to thank Rhonda Anderson Stimson.
Yeah, Rhonda.
We want to thank Kate Glasson. Yeah, Kate. We want to thank Elizabeth Page Carlisle.
Yeah, Elizabeth.
We want to thank Beth Lyle or Lale.
Yeah, Beth.
And we want to thank Paul Wellman.
Yeah, Paul.
Well, it's probably actually pronounced Wellman. And not well, man, but, you know.
Anyway, I hope you're doing well, man.
Yeah. Guys, thank you all so much for your patronage. It means the world to us. We really, really appreciate it. It really helps us keep the lights on and keep this show at the same level of quality it's always been. I'm not going to say where that level is, but it keeps it there. So, guys, thank you so much for that. If you haven't already, head over to videoblocks.com/notalone. Take advantage of those great savings, those great offers for this holiday season. And speaking of the holidays as well, we do have t-shirts up there at notalonepodcast.threadless.com. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. If you or anybody you like or know, even kind of as an acquaintance, listens to this show, buy them a shirt. I'm sure they'll love it. It's good stuff. You can also get like sweatshirts and hoodies. Jason is going to come out with some baller designs because we got a new thing that we can use to make art.
Yes, and I can make it better and prettier.
And he can make it better and prettier with transparent backgrounds.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait.
So we'll have a lot of new designs coming up in the future. But yeah, for right now, I think that does it for us. You can find us on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Not Alone Podcast. Wherever podcasts are sold, you can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. And yeah, who did it last week? I think it was me.
Okay.
Yeah, because mine was about killing an old man.
Yeah, that's right. Yours was really morbid.
Yeah, it was really bad.
Okay, so remember, whether you're making up stories at the local pub to hide your counterfeiting, or if you're wailing at night to drive down your neighbor's property value, we are not alone.